The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Some years back during the Obama administration, I spent a lot of time interviewing Secretary of State John Kerry for a profile that we published at the end of 2015. He was trying to talk down tensions between Israel and the Palestinians and to broker a peace in Syria. Kerry seemed to relish jobs that others might think absolutely impossible. He is considered relentless, I wrote in 2015, sometimes to a fault. There's no concealing his eagerness to make a deal. To a critic, his style is reminiscent of the customer who sternly tells the salesman, "I'm not leaving here until you sell me a car." But if peace in the Middle East certainly eluded Kerry, his current project seems a great deal harder still. Kerry is now serving as the Special Envoy for Climate, a cabinet-level post created by President Biden. Kerry needs to reverse our standing in the world on climate policy following 4 years of Trump's denialism. And the clock is ticking even louder as the effects of climate change become brutally apparent to us all over the world. I spoke with John Kerry last week. You were just in Europe to drum up support for climate action in advance of talks in October in Glasgow, which are essential. You've said that these are the last chance to keep temperature rises below 1.5 degrees Celsius. What is your sense of the state of the world on this, the sense of urgency? Because, you know, we're constantly getting warnings, this is the last chance. And here we are in a summer of what seems to be apocalyptic conditions already.
Well, they are apocalyptic, and it's more serious than it's ever been at a time that it seems as if some key nations are just unwilling to do their part, to bite the bullet and step up. So let me put that in perspective. At the summit that President Biden hosted last April, we had about 40 nations there, but we had the 20 largest economies who happen to also be the largest emitters of CO2.
More or less the 20 largest.
Well, 55% of global GDP out of that meeting committed to try to hold the Earth's temperature to the 1.5 degrees. And 45% therefore did not. And that includes China, Russia, India, South Africa, Brazil, a host of countries. So we have to move those countries. And David, if we don't get them to buy into faster reductions from 2020 to 2030, 1.5 degrees is dead. You won't be able to achieve it.
1.5 degrees centigrade.
1.5 degrees centigrade limit on the rise of Earth's temperature. So I do view this personally, after a 30-year journey on this, I view this as the last best hope for the world to get serious and make the decisions necessary to try to reduce and hold the 1.5, and even 1.5. Imagine what happens at 1.5 if you already see what's happening at 1.2. Is that what we want? You would think not.
Describe for me what it's like to talk to the Chinese on these issues? What is the dynamic? What is the back and forth that occurs? What is their rationale, as you understand it?
I mean, China, for instance, is a contradiction, because China has deployed more renewables than any other country in the world. But China has used an extraordinary amount of fossil fuel to get where it is in its economy. China's rationale is that they are doing a great deal, that they're doing more than most developing. They consider themselves a developing country still. And they posture that a developing country has a right at this point to be able to develop more. Our counter, obviously, is we want you to develop. We're fine with you developing, but you don't have to develop dirty. You don't have to develop by putting, you know, more coal-fired power plants online. And that's what's been happening in the last few years. China, regrettably, has continued to build coal-fired power plants and to fund them in other countries around the world.
To make the politics even more vexed, even more complicated, the U.S. has accused the Chinese government of genocide against the Uyghurs on a very large scale. How can you accuse someone of genocide, however grounded in reality, without doubt, and yet at the same time get them to cooperate with you on a political, a technological, ecological problem of such huge scale and importance?
Well, obviously, difficult. It takes a discipline to do it. But both President Biden and President Xi agreed in their initial conversations and in public statements that the climate crisis is so serious that they would separate it, that this would be a track on which hopefully we can compartmentalize and actually make progress. And historically, big nations with great power have been able to do that. Gorbachev and Reagan and Reykjavik decided we would stop pointing 50,000 warheads at each other and move to reduce those numbers way down to about 1,500. It happened. Despite the fact that Reagan believed the Soviet Union was the evil empire. So in terms of international affairs and diplomacy, we on my team are taking both leaders at face value that this is a separate issue. It doesn't mean that every arm of the government is going to stop saying something about Uyghurs or human rights, but it does mean that we have the ability to be able to separate things and work where our common interests require us to work.
How costly was the behavior of the Trump administration regarding climate? What did it cost us in terms of time? What did it cost us in terms of every time you walk into a negotiating room with foreign partners?
The damage that President Trump wreaked worldwide, not limited to climate, but on climate, he did a whopper of a job of putting America's credibility in a terrible place, destroying it fundamentally. I hear from country after country, how do we know we can count on America? How do we know that, another president is going to come along or someone like Trump who does the same thing again? And I mean, my answer is very simple, that I don't believe any one politician can come along in the future and turn this tide, because all around the planet, private sector is moving rapidly to do what governments aren't doing. There's a major undertaking by banks, by asset managers, by corporations who are considering ESG in the boardrooms and who have made commitments to the Sustainable Development Goals. There are trillions of dollars now moving to invest in alternative renewable energy, whether it's solar, hydro. There's just a phenomenal amount of economic activity being generated. And I don't think any politician would want to turn it around, frankly, in a few years, but also I don't think they could.
Considering all the political context you've just provided, one of the difficulties here is it demands sacrifice of everyone to avert catastrophe. Transitioning to renewables is going to cost trillions of dollars and upend huge industries. We're likely to have to eat less meat, use more public transportation. All of this is necessary. To what degree are you and Joe Biden and your foreign counterparts really leveling with everybody, with whether it's each other or with all of us, all the way down to the lowest level?
David, I think we're being completely direct and totally transparent, and I don't agree with you that this is sacrifice. I don't agree with that. I do not believe people will have to necessarily eat differently. I mean, agriculture will change. There's a lot of research and work being done now on diet of cattle, for instance. And there's a thing called asparagosis, I believe that's the right name, which is a seaweed that has been very apparently in its early trials has reduced, if not eliminated, flatulence from cattle. And I'm confident that there will be huge research done that will change some of these things. And all of the economic analyses show that there are millions of jobs to be created. The United States, we need to build a legitimate grid. We can go to the moon. We can direct a rover on Mars. We can invent vaccines. But we can't send a simple electron from California to New York. So in the building of that smart grid in America, you will put electricians and plumbers and pipe fitters and steel workers and heavy equipment operators and countless disciplines to work. And there's so many exciting parts of this. I mean, cars will be electric, not internal combustion engine. But you're still going to have workers, United Auto Workers, producing those cars. And I just think we're looking at a remarkable transformation. This will be the biggest economic transformation since the Industrial Revolution, literally.
Secretary Kerry, if I go to Fox News, I see a lot of these efforts mocked as they're going to come and take away your hamburgers. If I turn to the Senate, you looked at the first of the Biden administration's big infrastructure bills, and it was supposed to contain all sorts of climate measures. And that got gutted from the bill when Senate Republicans opposed it. How do you sell bold climate policy to Republicans?
There are more and more Republicans, I think, David, who are really now beginning to take this more seriously and who are trying to figure out what actions they are prepared to support. And I understand even in the House of Representatives, I think there has been some movement among some. What I think is that Mother Nature is messaging pretty forcefully right now. Temperatures going up. The storms are getting more intense. The fires are bigger and more expansive and more frequent. So I think increasingly leaders are taking note of this and recognize. For instance, President Putin was very clear. They have a real challenge in the northern part of Russia, in Siberia, in the tundra. The permafrost and the tundra are thawing. They have cities there where they're becoming unstable. They're deeply concerned about the methane that is being released after 40,000 years of containment in the earth. So Mother Nature is kind of screaming at people, hey, guys, you know, you got a problem.
Mother Nature is screaming at them. But in Russia, for example, you have an economy that's based almost entirely or to a huge measure on an oil industry.
Correct. They are an extractive economy. And we've talked very directly about that with Russia. But they have an ability now because they produce gas. Russia has an option of quickly closing coal plants that are more than 40 years old, inefficient, not working that effectively and not needed, in favor of transitioning to gas for the moment. And I emphasize for the moment, because gas is still a fossil fuel and gas is mostly methane. So it leaks and it also produces CO2. So it's not, in our judgment, anything near a long-term solution unless somebody discovers 100% abatement.
You're going from one meeting to the next, one country to the next, laying the groundwork for what we hope will be a successful climate negotiation in Glasgow come November. What would be the best possible outcome in Glasgow, and what are the forces mitigating against it?
The best outcome would be in Glasgow that the 20 major economies are all in agreement that they're going to make the best cuts they can, according to the science, between 2020 and 2030. We want people to lay out plans for how they will get to net zero by 2050. And finally, I think the key will be to have cemented in through the finance structure, the $100 billion, the Green Climate Fund, that there will be money there to make this a just transition for people in parts of the world where they're taking the brunt of what is happening because of the developed world, and they can't afford to make the transition themselves and do what they need to do to contribute. The frustration here, David, is that we can meet this challenge, and we have the ability to be able to minimize the danger and help countries to adapt and build resilience, but there's no debate anymore about science. Anybody who is reading, listening, learning, knows this is actually happening now, and it's human beings who are adding the greatest amount of fuel to the fire.
Secretary Kerry, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
John Kerry, former Secretary of State, is the special presidential envoy for climate. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On the Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to the Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The evangelical movement in this country is at something of a crossroads. For some years now, the number of Americans who identify as evangelical Christians has been dropping. And as politics shifted to the right, some in the movement grew alarmed, and they've started to break away from that orthodoxy.
I found that me, as a pastor's wife, that I withdrew by the time we got to our final church in the final years. I had become increasingly silent about things, that I no longer spoke up in Bible studies or small groups because I felt like I couldn't say what I really thought.
Beth Allison Barr is a religious scholar who challenged her church's gender politics, and she felt the consequences very personally. Barr spoke recently with staff writer Eliza Griswold, who's been covering the evangelical church.
So one of the big rifts that we're seeing among American evangelicals comes down to gender and gender roles, both in the church, but also in the family and at home. The term that's used to describe these supposedly ancient biblical roles was coined in the 80s, and it's called complementarianism. At its most radical, it's a code word for women submitting to their husbands and letting them make the decisions in every way. One of the key figures in this emerging debate about Christian patriarchy is a professor at Baylor University, which is a Christian college in Waco, Texas, and her name is Beth Allison Barr. Barr's book is called The Making of Biblical Womanhood. And in it, she basically challenges the idea that these are traditional roles that women have played and instead traces the rise of biblical womanhood to a reaction against 1970s feminism.
modern evangelicals have a definition of womanhood, of what women are supposed to do, and they think it comes from the Bible. And my argument is that it does not come from the Bible, that it actually comes from culture, and that we can trace the history of how women's roles have changed over time, and how the Bible has been molded to fit those different cultures, and that what we think is biblical womanhood today isn't biblical. It's made in history.
So now what I have found really interesting is how your life tracks pretty directly with the evolution of these ideas in the 20th mm-hmm. and into the 21st century. So could you tell us a little bit about your personal experience with them?
So I grew up in a very small town in Texas. My parents were both Baptist, and so we went to the primary Baptist church in town, which was a Southern Baptist church. When I was young, in the early 80s, was a time when James Dobson's Focus on the Family was really starting to take off. And Focus on the Family was an initiative by James Dobson and some other Christian men who thought that the problem in American society was the breakdown of the family. And so their goal was to restore God's order to the family, which is the proper authority of husband over wife over children. And by doing this, this would fix the social problems of the world. So Focus on the Family had literature that became very popular in conservative churches. It also had a radio talk show. And in fact, that's where James Dobson, the founder of Focus on the Family, really, I think, took off, was with this radio show. And I remember when I was younger that my mother would listen to this radio. She often listened to it while she was doing household chores, while she was sewing. And so these ideas that women are made to follow the leadership of men were part of my childhood.
One of the things I found fascinating and learned from you is that this tradition of complementarianism and this word that's so hallowed was actually coined in the late 80s. But the idea of complementarianism, like the conservative idea of women's submission, is rooted, conservatives might argue, in the scripture itself, right? So what passages support these arguments?
Right. So the passages that emphasize women not being in leadership roles are mostly the New Testament, mostly the Pauline letters. And in several of these letters that are written by Paul, as well as people who are associated with Paul, are what we call the household codes.
One of the examples you look at in the book is this section from one of his letters to the Corinthians, the people in Corinth, 14. This is one of those famous women be silent passages. And this is the text. Paul says, "As in all the churches of the saints, women should be silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but should be subordinate, as the law also says. If there is anything they desire to know, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is shameful for a woman to speak in church." And then there's this weird turn, and Paul says, "Did the word of God originate with you, or are you the only ones it has reached?" And it sounds like he's arguing with all he's just said, like he's arguing with that very stricture that tells women to be silent. And when you lay that out in your book and apply the historical method to this passage, there's evidence to interpret Paul extremely differently.
So as a historian looking at these texts, I know that they are not written within a vacuum. They're not written to a 21st century audience. They're written to a first century audience. And so it's not surprising that the strategies that the authors of these texts use are strategies that are from their time period. So Paul's a first century educated Roman, and he is using the rhetorical strategies of his time to make his arguments, his persuasive arguments within his letters. And one of the strategies that he uses over and over again is when he cites what is wrong and then he refutes it. And that's the Corinthian perspective. Women should be silent in church and only ask their husbands at home. And then he turns it on its head. He refutes it in this in this accepted rhetorical strategy. He says, what? Did the word of God originate with you? The problem, however, is that in the late 19th and early 20th century, scholars begin to argue that you had to read the Bible at face value, that if the Bible was true, it had to be completely true, historically, scientifically, theologically, et cetera, and didn't have to be placed within its context to be understood. And so an example of this is a scholar named B.B. Warfield, who was at Princeton Theological Seminary, and he argued in the early 20th century that we may not like what Paul says, but Paul said for women to be silent, and essentially that's that. And this has become the predominant understanding among conservative evangelicals in the 20th century.
So some of the pushback against your book has been that it's really impossible to, let's say, whitewash what Paul is saying, or to make it sound like he's not saying women be silent in church if that's what it says in black and white. And the deeper question there is, can you really read patriarchy out of the Bible?
So the answer to that is no, you can't read patriarchy out of the Bible, but I think we can separate what the intentions are versus, you know, the historical reality of what humans do. I mean, I think this quest to be in power over other people is something that humans have been doing from the very beginning. And we see that in the Bible. We see the power struggles. And so patriarchy is a part of the Bible because patriarchy is a part of history. But I do believe that the God we serve is not a proponent of patriarchy. And I think all you have to do is look at Jesus and what Jesus does for women in the New Testament and realize that he is approaching women very differently from the rest of the world.
Now, the success of your book has been stunning, right? I mean, you're in your fourth printing. The book hit number 26 on Amazon. So now you are speaking to us from Waco, Texas.
I am.
And what has been the response to it from in your local community? And also, what have you been hearing from your readers?
So in my local community, I have heard mixed responses to the book. So a lot of the pastors are reading my book, and some, which I'm very thankful for, but many of them are troubled by the ideas that I put in it. And some of them are starting to post those ideas to their congregation, sort of as a, I don't know if it's a warning, but letting them know that they disagree with me. On the other hand, though, the women who go to these churches and even their husbands and their families are reaching out to me daily. Some of the people who have reached out to me that aren't local are pastors' wives. Their stories are so similar to my story, that their husbands were fired in brutal ways, like my husband was, when they tried to stand up for women or put women into teaching positions, and they lost everything.
So you too are a pastor's wife. So can you tell us a little bit about how did complementarianism, how did these ideas factor into your life as a pastor's wife?
Yes. During my marriage, I have been in four different churches as a pastor's wife. And I found that me as a pastor's wife, that I withdrew by the time we got to our final church in the final years, I had become increasingly silent about things, that I no longer spoke up in Bible studies or small groups because I felt like I couldn't say what I really thought. It came to a head in 2016. 2016 was just a hard year for us. There had been some things going on in the church. The gender hierarchy had been hardening over time. So we had begun to notice this. And as our ideas both had been evolving on this issue, we began to be more and more bothered by it. We also began to be bothered by it because we knew the impact that it had on the teenagers. And that was really disconcerting for us to know that we had teenage boys who thought that there was something about their bodies that made them be able to have spiritual authority over the girls in the room. I mean, that just is such a dangerous idea. So those things were upsetting us. And then there was also a very practical thing, is we couldn't find a leader for the high school Sunday school class. Finally, this one guy said, "I'll do it if I can co-lead, so I don't have to do it every Sunday." And so he asked a friend who wanted to do it, who was a woman. And so my husband and I were like, okay. And so we took that to the elders. We weren't allowed to present it in person. We had to write it and submit it to them for them to talk about it. And then they called us back and said, no, that we are not going to allow this. And that was the moment that my husband and I had to make a decision. You know, could we continue to stay in this church environment and keep our mouths shut? Or were we going to try to change what was going on in our church? And obviously, we chose to try and change it. But I remember my husband, we were in the garage, and he looked at me and he said, "If I do this, I will lose my job." But I actually didn't believe him, because I thought, these are our friends. These are the people that we've lived with, you know, for 14 years. They know us. Surely they won't let us get fired over us simply trying to get a woman to teach a Sunday school class. And 3 weeks later, my husband was fired.
Such a story.
And one morning when I came to church, they had set up a table to tell us goodbye, essentially. And it had a picture of my family on it, and it had some little cards. And it hit me very badly when I saw it, because I saw the pretending about how what had happened to us was a good thing. And I lost it. I just walked out, left, I went home, and I immediately pulled out my computer and I started writing a blog post. So it was sort of my manifesto to myself, and my manifesto that I was not going to lose my faith over this. And I started a series on rethinking Romans. And it led to a second series called Disrupting Christian Patriarchy. And it was that Disrupting Christian Patriarchy series that got the attention of an editor.
And you chose to stay within Christian publishing. Why was that?
Yeah. So the editor that approached me represented a Christian press. And I remember thinking, because I had some good friends who are also Christians and were doing trade press publishing and had gone with trade press with non-Christian publishers. And their audience was bigger and it had broader appeal. And one of my friends that I was talking to, she said, "You know, Beth, who are you talking to? Who is your audience?" And I was like, "It's Christian women." And one of the things is that Christian women read books. The Christian marketing system is just amazingly strong. The small group system where people do book studies together and all buy the same book and read them in their houses together. I mean, this is an incredibly strong part of evangelical culture.
So Beth, what would a feminist movement within evangelical Christianity look like? How does it work? If biblical womanhood can be made, how is it unmade?
Yeah. So churches have always been supported primarily by women, even though churches mostly have had male leadership. And so the fact is that churches cannot function without the women who form a large part of their volunteer workforce. All it takes is a few women in some of these churches to start some of these reading groups and then start asking questions. Like, well, why can't I talk? Why can't I pray on stage? Why can't I be a deacon? Phoebe was a deacon. Why, you know, deacons were in the early church. Why can't deacons be in our church?
That's historian Beth Allison Barr. Her book is called The Making of Biblical Womanhood: How the Subjugation of Women Became Gospel Truth. She spoke with The New Yorker's Eliza Griswold. Now, just one note, Barr's former church disputes her account and denies that her husband was fired because he tried to hire a woman as a co-teacher. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Jack Antonoff is a very busy man. In the midst of the long pandemic, Antonoff co-wrote and co-produced not one, but two albums with Taylor Swift. And one of those, Folklore, won the Grammy for Album of the Year. Antonoff was also hard at work producing other albums for Lorde, Lana Del Rey, and Claro, all of which are out this year. And the producer also has a record of his own coming out. The album is called Take the Sadness Out of Saturday Night, and it's his third with the band Bleachers. It's the kind of music you want from a Jersey guy. Music you can blast while driving fast down the turnpike, heavy on the horns, and the big emotions. I spoke with Antonoff recently, and he was in his home studio with guitars and recording gear all over the place. And in the corner, the bust of a former president. Is that John Kennedy?
Yeah. My dad had this Kennedy bust in the house.
So it's you in the Oval Office have that?
Yeah, it's a really good vibe.
Now, Jack, you have a new album. It's called Take the Sadness Out of Saturday Night. It makes me want to ask, how are your Saturday nights right now? How has the pandemic treated you and your work?
I've been okay. I wonder if you can relate as a writer, where it's like I drift into spaces that were always alone spaces. And so a lot of my life in the pandemic was this knowledge of how intensely the world had changed, but my body was doing the same thing. You know, this room I'm in right now, I'm in, the door shuts and that's that. But the pandemic was like, look, I think it was a wonderful, it was devastating, but the one mega upside was it kind of hit the gas on this feeling that's been bubbling of the futures here, and we're all bored out of our minds, you know. Everyone's got a personal assistant on their phone. I want a burger, it comes. Martin Scorsese makes movies for me on Netflix, you know. I sit home and it all gets pumped in. And all of a sudden, no matter where you sit, whoever you are on any spectrum of politics, class, religion, anything, you can't find a person who's like, my ideal Saturday night is to watch Netflix and order food, you know. So I think that's good, because I think that the whole, the future's here and we kind of want to walk into traffic, is, it's good to recognize.
Now, you tweeted that you felt very heavy about this album. What did you mean? Where's that weight coming from?
I spent so much time writing about grief and loss. My sister died when I was 18. It's a very singular experience. It's a tragic experience in my life. And it took me years to realize the space around it, which I think is an interesting trapdoor with trauma. I noticed it with friends, especially if you're young, or, you know, I was 18 as a formative time. It becomes the rug in which everything gets swept under. Everything is, well, your sister died, your sister died, your sister died, or this trauma, this tragedy. And I think this thing happens where you become like sort of a personal genius in one language of grief, but like an infant in everything else. All those years that my friends were examining themselves and their tendencies and their parents, I was just sort of like, anything dark with me is from this trauma. And that's not true. And that's actually a really dangerous place.
To be crude, you mean it was an excuse or a catch-all in some way?
Yeah, it is. And it's this album got really heavy for me because I, for the first time, I knew I wasn't going to write another batch of songs about grief because I, it's something that lives you forever, but I felt like I'd explored it. So then I started exploring all these other things, and this is where, you know.
What did you feel you were exploring in this album?
All the things I missed because I kicked everything under the rug of grief.
And what are we including there?
I mean, not to be too broad, but the way why I'm this way, my tendencies, the systems in my family that don't work, the ones that do. I came to take the sadness out of Saturday Night because what I started to realize is that there's an evil eye. It might be Jewish, it might be cultural, it might be my specific family. There's a darkness that hangs pretty intensely, and I want more out of my life, and I want to break into the next phase of my life, and that's weird. So I kept seeing this image of a doorway, and there's all this hope and joy on the other side, right? There's all this frustration and anxiety of, like, sometimes it's literal, like, you're holding this baggage, and it's like, you can't take it all through it. It doesn't work. I do not get through this door with all this shit. I know that. You know, I wrote songs called, like, How Dare You Want More.
Well, I was just going to ask you about this.
Very
Tell me
pointed.
About that song.
That song came from letting go of some anger towards my parents. Because I found some things out, and when I started to, like, really look at their relationship and our home life, and, you know, nothing horrible, but just stuff in which I'm like, God, you put this crap on me, and I got to live with it. It's the reason why I have all this trouble. And you know, after some time, I started to say, no, these are human characters who want more, you know. And I'm not talking about money. I'm not talking about a bigger house, obviously. I'm talking about more. You know, more out of your life and the things you really desire. So much darkness wrapped up in that for people. There's no amount of sort of work success that ever makes one feel better about these, like, big rubs in their personal life. They're just separate. They're just separate.
You worked with Bruce Springsteen on one of these songs, and he has talked about, I mean, late in his career, he's talked about battling with depression for year after year and comes and goes, but he didn't really confront it until middle age. Is that useful to you, to talk to other musicians who are older than you, not just about the music, but about the experience of this seeming ideal creative life, successful creative life, and the realities of when you come home from the performance?
Remarkably important to me. I would call it, like, soul saving. Bruce and Patty are incredibly, I've touched on a little bit here and there, but incredibly important figures in my life because, you know, there's a lot of people who have great careers. And there's a lot of people who have really, you know, kind of like great, robustly vulnerable personal lives. There are very few people who can hold both. And if you're out there trying to have both, which I am, which, you know, there's a certain shame that even comes in saying that. How dare you want more? Man, you better find some people to believe in.
Yeah, we both have to fess up. We grew up in neighboring towns. You a little bit after me, of course, you in Wycliffe Lake and me in a town nearby called Hillsdale. And what that turf, which I was when I was growing up there, which I thought of as terribly boring, couldn't wait to leave, you know, get me to New York as soon as possible. What did that turf give you in your creative life?
Well, I felt the same way. It gave me boredom, which gave me dreams. You know, I always, you know, we're obviously diving deep into a lot of, like, Springsteen culture, but one of the reasons why his work means so much to me is there's a fine line between loving music and hearing yourself and your experience. I mean, when I heard it started with him, he's the architect of it, then it was this local scene, then all of the other great music from the shore that I started to discover. You know, first of all, it's the literal landscape. You're hearing streets and places you know, but it's this feeling that there isn't really a word for it. You could say outside the window of the party. You could say younger brother. You could make the medieval comparison, calling the Hudson River a moat. But it's deeper. It's, you know, it's our culture. It's we are not there, but we are right there, which is It's not small town thinking. It's a whole, I mean, let's look at it scientifically. How much energy is coming off of New York City and then dying as it hits New Jersey? I think we grew up in the sort of like metaphorical ash of energy.
All of New Jersey would be thrilled to hear it.
Yeah, but here's the thing, you know, how much beauty does that create? I mean, let's look at New York music, right? Velvet Underground, Strokes, right? Reporting from the center of the world. It's all been there, done that. The first Stroke record when I was younger came out was called Is This It? Question mark. Mm-hmm. You know, let's compare and contrast Is This It with Born to Run. You know, like, I mean, and it's true in my life. The kids I met, I just wanted to be in the city. I wanted to be a New York City band. I wanted to be around it. I fucking grew up knowing every band that was playing in the city that night and not being able
to go. Yeah.
But it creates darkness and it creates a lot of hope. It creates dreams. There's somewhere to go. It's almost like people who have a very successful father seem to have a tough time. And I feel like growing up in New Jersey, I had nowhere to, and I was lucky. You know, we never worried about food on the table. You could look it up. It's a nice town. We had a nice house. I played t-ball. I went to Jewish school. Like, you know, our worries were not deep. But I never thought that I couldn't outdo my upbringing.
Now, what has stunned me musically about you over time, and is how much music and musical styles you've incorporated into your work as a musician, as a producer. How does that happen? Did you grow up liking music, country music, for example?
Well, yes and no, because I look back. Well, my dad, interesting story about my dad is there's a ragtime musician named Reverend Gary Davis.
Guitar player,
and brilliant.
And everybody loved getting lessons from him, all kinds of people.
My dad was one of them.
Yeah.
So I think it was Bergenfield, New Jersey. I think at the time, you could go get a lesson from Reverend Gary Davis, which is crazy.
Unbelievable.
And amazing. So my dad learned in that style, and the style is very specific. It's this sort of fast back and forth picking.
It's really hard.
One sec.
Sure.
Sorry, I'm just grabbing this off the wall.
If you can do this, I'm always impressed with you, but if you can do this, you're my hero.
It's really hard, but this is like, so I'm going to play something really poorly that my dad plays great. It's like this kind of style. Fuck, it's like, hold on. Okay. So it's that kind of, and that's a...
See, if I could do that, I would die happy. Immediately.
But then, yeah, so the level, if you see my dad do it, it's a language, this kind of playing. And it flows through you where your thumb is moving back and forth seamlessly and you're picking in between. It's got all these blues undertones and just southern undertones, and there's even like this jazz to it. Long story short, I think it opened this idea of me of just like, oh, like there's different kinds of music, because it wasn't just popular music flowing through the house.
You're known not only as a musician and as a writer, but also as an extremely successful and varied producer working with other people. You've done albums with Lana Del Rey, with Lorde. You've done a lot of this since your last album with Bleachers. At what point did producing other artists really take hold for you?
Well, the funny thing about being a producer, and I've only sort of, I realized this when I was getting into it, like if you're a songwriter, you can write songs. If you're a performer, you could probably find an open mic night and you might get booed off the stage, but you're a performer. You can't really be a producer unless someone admits that you're a producer. And so I always produced my own records and loved it. But if you do it for yourself, it's a little bit more like, oh, you just kind of make your own records. It's really that lens that someone else sees you through, where they're like, oh, this person can be my producer. And Taylor Swift was the first person who said, we made a song together and I made it sound like everything I wanted it to sound like. And she said, cool, that's that. And that kicked the door wide open.
Jack, one of the collaborations that is really knocked me flat, and it also surprised me when I first heard about it, is you've got a song on the album called 91.
Yeah.
And your collaborator is one Zadie Smith. Tell me
about
that.
That's your world.
So tell me how it came about.
I know Zadie a little bit, and I ran into her near Electric Lady, which is in the West Village. And I'm sure you know Zadie. You know, she's not someone that's like high and by it, sort of like high, and then 5 minutes later, it's like, and that's why this crushing weight is in tow wherever I go. And what do you think of matcha? You know, it's a sort of, she's a heavy character.
And she can sing, by the way.
She can really sing, and she loves music. So I thought, you know, I work with people who are in music. Zadie's a brilliant writer. I have this song, which I'm having a very, very hard time with. What if Zadie helped me frame it? You just sort of give this unknowing permission where you make space for someone to be like, you know what you could do there? And that was the story with Zadie, and she helped me put it together. She actually sings on a little bit. And the interesting thing about 91 is then I had this mountain with the production. I just could not get that song right. And it ended up being Zadie helping me with the lyrics, St. Vincent coming up with the idea of the strings, and then Warren Ellis, who plays in the Dirty Three and the Bad Seeds, one of my favorite musicians in the world, playing those parts. And it made me feel like this sort of cast of heroes of mine kind of pushing me into the album.
It's 91, Arizona, watching black, white, and green. My mother dances around like there ain't no rip in the scene. While she waltzes with ghosts, I can feel what went wrong. Yeah, she's here, but she's not. Just like her, I'm not home. Just like her, I'm not home. Just like her, I'm not home. Yeah, I'm here, but I'm not.
Just now, you like haven't played in front of a live audience, I assume, in quite a while, right?
Once. I played, when we played How Dare You Want More on Fallon, there was 100 people there. And that was my first audience in, you know, I guess 2 years.
How'd that feel?
It felt amazing. It wasn't my audience. I mean, there were a couple people, but, you know, there was also some people who, I guess, were probably at the gift shop of 30 Rock and got handed tickets. So, so those things are always a funny audience. But look, I think it's that cliche, you know, the car hits empty and there's that secret 20 miles. My grandfather, who is a rabbi, used to talk about this all the time, about human reserve. And I think it's a metaphor that comes to mind about live music. There's no part of me that ever thought it could be more special, more important, that we could go harder. And here we are. My first show is actually on September 11th. And I know it will be more. I don't know if I will be weeping. I don't know if the crowd will be weeping. I don't know if we'll disassociate. I don't know what the hell's going to happen, but it's going to be big.
I will be there. I will make it a point. Jack, thanks so much. It's really great talking to you.
Great to see you, David.
That's Jack Antonoff. Take the sadness out of Saturday Night. This is his third album with Bleachers, and it's out now. And that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botin, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen and Putubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses,
Annabelle Bacon,
and Stephen Valentino.
And we had additional help from Harrison Keithline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.